Hey, folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Mason. Today we're talking to Will Collins. Will was back on the show in 20, gosh, I can't even remember, but it's in the show notes. He was on to talk about his through paddle of the Mississippi River, paddling the whole length of the Mississippi River, which was amazing. And today he, in my opinion, he one-upped himself by through paddling the entire Yukon River, all through Canada and Alaska. And if you know anything about the Yukon River, man, it is way out there, and you were in some wilderness, maybe some of the most remote places in North America, which is pretty amazing. So totally different experience in a lot of ways than the Mississippi River, but I'm sure similar in some. But we get into it. Will is awesome. And if you don't know, he hosts the show Buffalo Roamer. And that show is similar to ours, actually, interviewing really interesting people doing interesting adventures all over the world. So check that out, Buffalo Roamer. And I'm actually going to be on that show soon. I'm not sure how it lines up with this one. Maybe you're tired of my stories, so I'm not going to take that personally. But Will was awesome to talk to. Great conversation. And just love what he's doing in this world. So in this adventure scene, in this adventure world. So before we jump in, too, today is the last day to check out. Actually, no, it's the first day to check out Journey to 100 virtually. If you have heard anything about this new documentary that Athletic Brewing made, by the way, that's where I work, about a former guest on the show, Jason Hardrath. We made a documentary about his journey to 100 fastest known times. And that is actually coming out today on YouTube. And it's also going to be available, I think, tomorrow on Outside TV, which is Outside Magazine's like TV platform thing. So if you're at all on any of those platforms, you'll be able to see it tonight at 8 p.m. on YouTube, on Athletic Brewing's YouTube channel. Check it out. There is a link in the show notes if you want to learn more. But anyway, let's go ahead and jump into Will's story. And thanks for tuning in. Will Collins, welcome to the show, and yeah, happy to have you back on after a few years. How you doing?
Yeah, absolutely, Mason. Yeah, it's great to reconnect, and looking forward to being on the show. As I was saying, I like listening to the episodes, and yeah, good to reconnect. And with me having my own podcast, the Buffalo Roamer podcast now as well, and still doing adventures. Good as time as any to talk about adventures and rivers and all kinds of fun stuff, right?
Yeah, man, absolutely. So we had you on back in 20. Oh, before I start that, where are you coming from today? That's the first question I always like to ask.
So I am in a small closet on the second floor of a small farmhouse here in northern Illinois, which is where I live and run a farm here.
Do you really? Wow. Run a farm. What, yep. Tell us about the farm. What's all going on with that?
Oh, the farm's great. Yeah. So it's my family's farm here, and we have pigs. We raise market hogs. So if you go to the grocery store and grab a package of bacon, that's the type of stuff that we produce. So we raise the pigs, and then we sell them at market weight to the butcher, who then processes them. And yeah, and then we also have a bunch of corn and soybean as well.
No kidding. Wow. I raised a couple hogs growing up. Well, an individual, you know, like sure. As an FFA, if you've ever heard of that. And,
oh yeah,
I'm sure. And it was heartbreaking, man. I had to sell my hogs, and the money was nice. It actually helped pay for my first apartment when I left. But
oh, that's awesome!
But yeah, it really sucked having to say bye to old Ringo and Tusk. If you're out there somewhere, sorry, buddies.
That's funny. Yeah, it's one of those things. You know, I'm pretty happy with it, and yeah, I like what we do, and it's fun, and it's always different. I work outside, so that's always enjoyable, and fixing stuff and trying to fix problems. So yeah, I like doing it.
And now, Will, you know, you're in an area that maybe kind of like me, where people aren't they don't think of it as the first location for an adventurer to live. Are you like a an outsider with the, are you the like the black sheep of the family in ways? Like, this it's crazy funny, dude.
It's funny, Mason. I feel like I've come full circle, to be honest. I bounced around. So I grew up here in Illinois. Then I bounced around after high school. I went out west to college in Boulder, Colorado. Boulder,
that's right.
And then I was in South Dakota for 3 years, working in radio. And then I went to Montana, and then I did the Mississippi trip, which was 103 days canoeing the Mississippi when I was in South Dakota. And then I left South Dakota and did the Yukon trip, which we're going to get into today, across Alaska. And after that trip, came back, and I was in Montana for just a short little bit, year and a half, 2 years. And then just the past couple of years, I've been back here in Illinois. But with that, it's come like full circle, right? When I was out of Illinois, I was all gung ho about being in the mountains, and I love the mountains. But now I've kind of settled in back in the Midwest, where it's like, yeah, I don't really have to not brag, but sometimes some towns in the West can be a little pretentious about their outdoor sports. And I'm happy in the Midwest, and it's a little more content, and you know, it's not really boasty, and there's a lot of awesome rivers and low key great spots to go to. So yeah, I like it, man.
You know, Will, this is so perfect for our show, because we constantly preach, you don't have to be in a Boulder or in a Bozeman or Flagstaff or somewhere like that, Sacramento or something, where people have this, you know, really close proximity to these amazing places. It's awesome to be there, but you don't have to be there to be a true adventurer and to do amazing things. You don't have to feel discontent about that. I live in the South, and I'll be honest, my wife and I like side-eye each other all the time, thinking like, yeah, I think we made the right decision here, because it's like you said, it's not boastful. Everyone you run into was a former Olympic athlete. You know what I mean? Just right. Everyone going down the trail in Boulder is some incredible athlete. It's a little bit daunting to try to find your way.
It can be.
You know, it's kind of hard to like.
Absolutely.
I feel like where you are now might allow for some room to dream a little bigger. Funny enough.
I completely agree. Yeah. And I have the same feelings. And also, I think no matter where you are, at least I hope, even in some cities, you can get out, like in Chicago, which is not far from me. You could still get out to some wilderness areas, but you just have to look a little harder. But yeah, there's a lot of awesome rivers around here that I love to get out and paddle. And I feel like they're underused. So
exactly.
Sense.
You kind of get it to yourself, which is an adventure in itself. You know, here in the Florida, quote, Florida wilderness, there's plenty of it. And I tell people, like in Colorado, I felt invited into the outdoors because the culture, the search and rescue, the trail systems, the maps that existed here. It's like, I freaking dare you to come out here. It's a little more hardcore in a lot of ways. And it's like, dang, absolutely. this is a real adventure trying to get out in the swamp.
Yeah, nobody's coming if something happens.
No, they're like search and rescue. Knows. We'll call Bill. Exactly. He'll come with his dogs looking for you, but that's about it. Well, Will, what did you, before we jump into UConn, I want to know, what did you do in radio? Because when I was listening to the story of you being on the show the last time, I was getting ready, just listening to, you know, who you are and just more about it. Because I remember hearing the podcast originally, but I needed a refresher. And the first thing I thought was, like, man, this guy's voice is great. What did you do in radio? And are you still at all involved in that? Or is it just transitioned into the podcast?
Yeah, it's just transitioned into the podcast. When I was in Boulder in school, I studied journalism and broadcast journalism specifically. And I wanted to be a play-by-play, like a sports broadcast announcer. My two loves always, I guess, were the outdoors and sports. And growing up as a kid, I guess it was more tilted towards sports than the outdoors. The outdoors was always still there. And then as I got older, I think it shifted more towards the outdoors and away from sports, maybe in part because I worked in it, in the sports for a little bit. But yeah, and so in school, I studied journalism, and then I worked at a radio station in Denver at 850 KOA. I got hooked up with a couple guys there, Andy Lindahl and Mark Johnson, who were kind of two of my mentors. They were broadcasters at KOA. So I was a sports talk producer. I produced a sports talk show with Andy Lindahl there in the evenings on 850 KOA. And then from there, I moved to South Dakota, which is why I moved to South Dakota for a job. And I took a on-air job doing country music, a country radio station like Hot Country, and play-by-play, which was the part that the reason I took it. I did all the local high school sports within the area in South Dakota. I did that for about 3 years before, deciding to kind of move on.
Wow, man. High school sports. Is there a sport of you particularly enjoy covering play-by-play?
Oh, play-by-play, I really actually do like basketball because the way the game flows, it's quick and just kind of always going. But I prefer to watch football for sure. I love football. And the cool thing about South Dakota, I didn't know anything about South Dakota before I moved there, but it's an outdoorsman's paradise, especially if you like to hunt and fish. There's like no better place to be than South Dakota, which I found out when I was there. Also, as far as the job when I was there, people in South Dakota, there's no NFL. The major college team is like South Dakota State in South Dakota, which is, 1AA, Division II. So high school sports there are big. So everybody listens to the games on Friday nights or goes to the games. And like, if you go to the bar at the weekend and like saddle up for a cold one, the guy next to you is probably talking about like the Watertown Arrows, the high school team, rather than, the Dallas Cowboys, which is great for, it's cool for community and also obviously for my job, which was calling the games.
That is so interesting, Will. Holy cow. I did not know that. Dang, man, we've got a lot in common. I love basketball and high school too. My wife teaches at a very prominent high school with one of the best teams in the nation. So it's like being cool. NBA courtside every week when I get to go to games.
Yeah, that's
all these
awesome.
Dudes are going pro and or at least D1. And it's like, I love that. I love having that aspect. I can take this off the record, but dude, ever since moving away from the West, I feel like my life's more well-rounded. You know what I mean? Like there's more balance
totally.
With things, other interests, like basketball is actually one of my big interests.
Sure.
Other sports, family, just a little more, it's not like extreme with awesome jagged mountains everywhere and being up in the mountains every weekend, but it's like more balanced with other great aspects of life. So nothing's extreme anymore, but everything's weirdly better. If that makes sense.
I completely agree, man. We share the same sentiment there, man. I really like the Midwest and for you, the South, but yeah, it's the same thing. It's like, there can be a little bit, especially in these hotspot towns, like I was in Bozeman and, a few other places. And, there's like a buzz about being the biggest, baddest mountain climber or angler or trail runner or whatever. Whereas it's nice just to be able to do whatever have the space, I guess, to feel like you can, just float down the river or, there's just no pretentiousness about the outdoors.
Yeah.
And around here. And yeah, I completely agree, man. I really like it.
That's awesome, man. And it hasn't kept you from dreaming big. That's for sure.
No, I
want to get into, last time we talked, and I'm going to obviously tell people like here's, because your last episode was two parts. It was so long and it's just awesome. Like that's such a bucket list item for our community is the Mississippi River. But there's one I want to focus on this time, which is the Yukon, which you did later that year. We had you on, I think we interviewed you in December of 2017, and then the episodes came out right at the new year. And then later that year, you went down the Yukon River. Can you tell us like what made you think of that and how you started preparing for that and kind of what led to those plans?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Just talking about it, I have like a big smile on my face because they're just an amazing trip. So the way the Yukon came to be basically is when I was on the Mississippi, I did the Mississippi trip solo. And just like a little refresher, it was 103 days, 2,400 miles more or less. And I did that one solo. And one day when I was on the river, it was maybe like day 80 or something like that. And I was just having such a blast. I texted my buddy Jackson, who I ended up doing the Yukon with. And I was like, hey, man, we got to paddle a big river together. This is amazing. And sure enough, he's crazy enough that he was like, sweet, let's do it. He just happened to work out in his life where, you know, he could take a couple chunks off to do it. And I really couldn't because I had taken a leave of absence from the radio gig in South Dakota to come back and keep working at the radio. So I had already like worn everything thin, asking to go for 100 days on the Mississippi and still come back. But I went back and worked for a little bit and was like, you know what? I think the Yukon's calling my name. And I was kind of ready to shift careers, I guess, anyway. I wouldn't have done it without Jackson, that's for sure. Jackson like kind of kept my foot to the fire when we were talking, like in the build up to preparation for the trip, you know, he'd be like, all right, we're going. You know, kind of like half-heartedly like, yeah, okay, we'll go. But yeah, push came to shove. And I kind of knew like deep in my gut, it was something that I wanted to do. It was like a wilder experience. At least I thought going in into it than the Mississippi. Is like the Yukon River. It's the third largest river in North America, third or fourth, second, I think, or third in America. The Mackenzie is the only one in Canada that's longer. So it's really big, really raw and remote. It traverses Alaska. It starts in Canada and Whitehorse and then cuts. Again, it's almost like, I forget the exact mileage, but it's somewhere around 2,400 miles as well. And it basically bisects Alaska north and south. It's the biggest watershed of Alaska and dumps into the Bering Sea. And yeah, basically, I just knew in my gut that it was going to be epic and awesome, and I really kind of had to do it. So I made preparations to leave my gig in South Dakota and moved all my stuff to a storage unit in Bozeman, which is where Jackson was based out of. And we basically, for like a week or two, we staged everything in Bozeman, all of our gear and such and provisions, and packed up the boat and threw it on top of his old Jeep Wrangler and drove like 35 hours north to Whitehorse, which is a ways north when you're already going from Montana.
Oh, yeah. I once biked from Fairbanks back to my house here.
Oh, geez.
And so became very familiar with the Alcan, but you, so your initial to get to the source of the Yukon, like where did you start? Right at the headwaters?
So we didn't actually start at the source, and we met some people since and on that trip. Definitely not a common trip, but people do it. We met some folks who started at the headwaters. It starts in like some glacial lakes south. Ironically, it runs north for the first few miles, but south of Whitehorse in the Yukon territory. And they're like crystal clear alpine, like glacial runoff, turquoise color lakes. And then it starts right after the actual river, like the named river on a map, starts when it leaves Marsh Lake is the name of the lake. And that's where it becomes the Yukon River. And that's where we started, which is just right near the town of Whitehorse, which is like, I think 25,000 people or something, the capital of the Yukon territory.
Oh, yeah. I remember getting a Whitehorse and seeing our first subway and therefore our first vegetables on the whole trip. So we were like, God, please. Let me get funny. A sub, and it's like all $5 footlongs because this was like 10 years ago. And it's like, yeah. Nah, it's like $10 footlongs because everything's so freaking expensive up there.
Yeah, you got like 2-week-old lettuce.
Yeah, for real. It wasn't fresh. It was not the Subway Eat Fresh that we were used to. And they're usually not that fresh anyway, you know, so it was even worse. Well, dude, Whitehorse, what an adventure. So it was like a 35-hour drive just to get there. That feels like an adventure in itself. Did anything go wrong in the prep and how, you know, you had just done the Mississippi River. So I'm sure you were feeling pretty confident in your abilities to paddle long distances. But what were some of the key differences between the Mississippi and the Yukon that you were maybe apprehensive about or maybe just needed to consider a little more? Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
Yeah, great questions. And I'm glad you asked about the drive because it's often overlooked.
That's an adventure, man.
It is. Yeah, man, it was. And also, it's fun to talk with you about the trip because, yeah, on my podcast, the Buffalo Roamer podcast, I'm always talking and we're going to have you on. So I'm excited to turn the tables on you too and talk about your bike trip and all your cool stuff. But it's fun to talk about my stuff for a change, you know?
It's so fun to be on that side of the mic. So
yeah,
it's good
to have the memories.
Yes.
But on the trip up, so this was somewhere, I forget exactly where we were, but we were far north in Canada and we were driving Jackson's Jeep. And of course, I was a rookie and not really adept with the stick shift. Now since being on the farm, you know, I'm all good. But at that point, I wasn't. And we were driving in the middle of the night. It was like 2 a.m. or so because we were going straight through the night. Two moose flash out in the middle of the road on this like middle of the nowhere two-lane highway in Canada. And I think I slam on the brakes. The car is still in gear. And I like swerve. And it's a mama moose, a big mama moose with a calf. Chasing her across the road, and I swerved and just like a tiny little thud, and the car meanwhile, like I said, I haven't taken it out of gear, so it's, you know, it's like punching forward, it's like jerking forward. He's like, take it out of gear. So I stop the car and we get back and look, and there's just like the tiniest amount of hair on like the front left side of the bumper. We had like skimmed the rear end basically of this moose calf. And the moose calf was like down on the side of the road and the mom was like pacing back and forth. Luckily, everything was fine. No damage to the car. The calf was still alive. We like watched her for a little bit and she kind of got up and whimpered away. But yeah, it was gnarly. We thought the trip was about to end right there, you know, like a few more inches to the left. And either of those moose through the windshield would not have been good.
Oh my gosh. That is wild. Yeah, because people, if you don't realize, moose are like, their backs are like 10 feet tall. It's like, imagine a horse on 3-foot stilts on all four legs. It's
animals.
Like, you take their legs out, unfortunately, how vehicles are designed, and the body, that, you know, 1,500-pound body, 1,000-pound body just falls right on top of the car, right through the windshield oftentimes. So, yeah, that would have been... Yeah. Devastating to your plans.
Yeah, absolutely.
Holy, and to the moose, unfortunately.
Yeah, luckily crisis averted, and we kept trucking on. And anyway, but on to the second part of your question, the Mississippi versus the Yukon. Yeah, like you said, I think I was feeling pretty confident. Jackson, we actually just talked about it not that long ago, and Jackson, looking back, was, you know, more apprehensive a little bit, understandably, because we'd done all kinds of camping trips together. But we hadn't, you know, obviously done a massive trip like this. So I think I was a little, I don't think I was apprehensive about the like wilderness aspect, because it's like rural, raw in the bush, Alaska. Like you're out there, like, you know, there's moments where you're 800 miles from the nearest road. And so you're out there alone. I think that was like a little intimidating, but more exciting probably. The bear stuff was a little worrying. I think when I was preparing, I was planning on bringing a firearm, but then Canada is super strict with firearms, and we started in Canada. So I was like, we'll just go with the bear spray. And, you know, things worked out, but in the planning stages, I think I was like a little apprehensive about that aspect of it, just being in like thick grizzly bear territory.
Like the thickest grizzly bear territory that you could imagine.
Exactly. Yeah, and we saw plenty of them. You know, a couple not close encounters, but a couple cool encounters. And yeah, it's definitely a wild place, that's for sure.
What kind of, I mean, you mentioned being 800 miles from a road. That is inconceivable to a lot of, I mean, that distance from where I am right now is like to Washington, D.C. or something.
Yeah, it's
insane.
A long ways, man.
What were you planning on how long the adventure taking? And did you have, you had a canoe, because you can take a bunch of stuff. How much were you pre-packing and how much were you relying on caches and resupply?
So we thought that the trip was going to take around 70 days, which ironically, I think it hit the nail on the head of 70 days. Not necessarily planning that way, just worked out, I guess. So it took 70 days, and that 800 mile number, I feel like that's right too. I know it was a long ways, but don't go, you know, with your measuring stick and check. I don't know, but we're out there. That's for sure. So we started in Whitehorse with a bunch of provisions. Like you said, we had one canoe. There was two of us. The canoe was like loaded to the brim, almost like taking on water when we started. And we had like a big blue, I don't know if you've ever seen those, I guess bear barrels. They're often used in canoeing. They're like big blue barrels that you store all your food in. So we had one of those packed to the brim, obviously all the camping provisions and stuff like that. And we planned, I believe it was 3 resupplies. We had like read and in our research that you could like send food ahead to some of these villages along the river and they would hold them for you. So Jackson had a contact who lived in Alaska and kind of gave us the update on like what villages were the main hubs of the Yukon. And so, yeah, we sent, I think it was 3 resupplies to villages that we picked up along the way.
Wow. I mean, I'm looking at a map of this right now, Will. You guys are so out there. I mean,
yeah, man.
So out there.
It's the middle of nowhere. And the coolest part was I thought like the Mississippi was all about the people and the river and like the history of America and all these river towns and stuff. And I really thought that the Yukon was going to be all about the wilderness, which it was. And like the, you know, just being in the middle of the bush, like in the middle of nowhere in the interior of Alaska. But it also turned out to be all about the people along the way as well. Like we ran into so many of these native villages that were just like awesome and like amazingly accepting, still like so like basically living off of the land, you know, catching all of their salmon to provide them and their like dog teams with food throughout the winter, you know, hunting moose. They have electricity. Some of them don't have plumbing. And just seeing these communities along the way, that was amazing and awesome too. And also, I think, kind of wild. Yeah, it was great.
That's awesome to hear. You know, that was one of my questions was how accepting were people and how often you saw people. But I do want to know, compared to the Mississippi, which great feedback there, like being a historical experience. I can totally see that and how it shaped America. I mean, it's such an iconic river here. Yukon is as well for different reasons, just being wild and big and way up there. What did you have to prepare for as far as water skills? Were there tons of rapids that you need to get ready with? Like, what did you know about that going in and how did that compare to the Mississippi?
Basically, we knew very little, man. We were just kind of, we had like a, there is one guidebook. I think it's called Paddling the Yukon and its Tributaries. And it's one, dare I say, badass dude who has paddled the Yukon and, as the title says, like all of its tributaries through paddledom. You should get that guy on. He's, I forget his name, Dan McLean or something. But
that is insane.
Yeah, he's gnarly and amazing. So he has this guidebook. So there was one guidebook to the river, but it's pretty sparse and it's more of like logistics, kind of like I said, like which villages to send resupplies to and kind of bare bones stuff like that. Super helpful. But we really didn't know much going in, honestly. We just kind of like drove up there and figured that we were going to start and just make it happen and try and, you know, finish at the Bering Sea. As far as the water and skill wise, it's a lot like the Mississippi in terms of, it's just a really big river. It's like really big, slow rolling. There's one set of rapids in the beginning in Canada called Five Finger Rapids. The name is more intimidating than the water, but other than that, it's just big, slow rolling. But it's like, you know, towards the end of the river, it could be like 4 or 5 miles wide at places or wider. And so that's like, you know, massive open water crossing. So the wind comes into play and there's all these side channels and sloughs as far as navigation and stuff. But yeah, it's an amazing river. But I think the easiest way to describe it, it's a big river, man. It's a big water.
I mean, I'm looking at it on the map and how did you navigate all the braidedness, if that's a word,
yes,
of the river? If people have never seen, go look at that. A braided river is such an interesting thing to look at. How did you choose the path to take?
Yeah. So there's like, there's, I kind of think the river, the Yukon, had like three distinct sections. There's the beginning section, which is in Canada mostly, and it's like a glacial runoff. The water's super turquoise, really clear, amazingly beautiful, super raw and remote. The whole thing is, but that part in particular too. And then after that, it kind of goes into, you enter into Alaska, into the U.S. near Eagle, Alaska, and it kind of forms into one big channel, one big river, like you would think of on the Mississippi. And then it gets to a section that you're talking about called the Yukon Flats. And that area near Fort Yukon, the village there, is super braided, man. It's like, yeah, so many intertwining and interwining fingers, super wide, all of these islands, really awesome. And it's a notorious area for people to get lost. But I don't know. Luckily, Jackson and I, we didn't have any issues navigation wise through there. We just kind of, maybe that in part comes to experience, I don't know, but we just, you know, follow the main channel and try and follow the fastest moving water. I think we had to like drag our boat over some dead water and sandbars a couple times, but nothing too bad. Yeah, we just kind of pointed it down river and went through the maze.
Wow. What you say you came across these towns and some folks that were living out there, these villages. What did people think about your adventure? Because I'm sure they were asking.
Oh, yeah. Most people thought we were crazy, of course. But they were also intrigued, you know. It's like, you know, these two, you know, these two white boys floating down in a canoe in the middle of nowhere, Alaska, pulling up on these towns and villages. And, you know, most of these places are like super removed. Not super removed, but, you know, I don't want to make it seem like it's middle of nowhere, but it is the middle of nowhere. And, you know, they don't have, these towns run off of generators. A lot of them don't have plumbing. Nicest, coolest people though. And their cultures are still like really thriving with all the elders. And we had some awesome experiences being welcomed into a memorial service in one of the villages, which was just like a crazy different experience than you would think of in a memorial service here in America, or not in America, but down in, you know, the lower 48. And yeah, they loved us, man. And we loved them. They were the nicest, kindest folk. We would float up and they would be like, "Where are you headed?" And we're like, "To the Bering Sea." And they're like, "Oh, that's a long way." You know, and it's interesting, the same as on the Mississippi, is that everybody's like familiar with their little section of river, but you know, these folk don't travel 2000 miles up and down the river. So they don't really know what's around like the next couple villages down. They've heard stories, but most folks haven't really traveled that far. So it's funny hearing people say like what's going to be coming up, like, "Oh, you'll want to stay away from this place, those people aren't good," or, "Oh, you know, watch out for this or that." And then of course you paddle and it's totally different than than what they'd warned about. But yeah, it was awesome, man. And the kindest people. We ate all kinds of fresh salmon, moose, you name it, man. And it was awesome,
dude. That is amazing. There's locals are awesome. Don't trust their directions, surprisingly, or their words of advice. Oftentimes, it's like, I was doing a trip on a river recently in Florida, and people are like, "Oh, gators are going to eat you out there," and I'm thinking, no, they're not. Like, have you ever been out there? Like, they avoid you like the plague. Like, it can be similar.
Exactly.
When you're right there in the elements. But, man, we had a guy on a few months ago, Luke Mell. He is legendary in Alaska. He grew up in a small, very small village along, it was McGrath. I don't know if that's along.
Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yukon or not.
No, but it's, I know of it. It's like a legendary mountaineering town, I think, right?
He's from there, grew up there his whole life, no roads. I mean, there's roads, but no, the only way to get there is by plane or boat. And he has done 10,000 miles on foot in Alaska in the wilderness, off trail.
Wow.
On foot. Yeah, it's the Kuskokwim River. And he was just saying some of the same things you were just saying, how wonderful the people are and just how, yeah, the culture, how growing up, he mentioned eating moose every day of his life, every meal of his life in some form or fashion. And it's just like, I'm sure you got a lot of moose out there.
Yeah, man. It's the same way up there. Yeah, in the interior, man. It's a lot of moose and a lot of salmon. Salmon is like the main currency and like as far as like food and commodities and stuff. And, you know, salmon strips, canned salmon, like jarred salmon. Yeah, they use salmon to feed their dog teams, which they still use to go run like trap lines in the winter. And yeah, it's very very awesome and wild. And yeah, you know, they have their problems like anywhere else, but they, I think, generally speaking, they love the way they live.
What was your welcome to Alaska moment, or Yukon, or British Columbia? I don't think it starts there. It's just north of Britain. But what's your welcome to Yukon or Alaska moment?
Great question. Definitely the welcome to Alaska moment, I think, for me was, and actually we were in the Yukon at this point, still in Canada, and we had just left, it was maybe day four or day five, we had just left Lake LaBarge, which is kind of a famous or infamous lake up there that the poet Robert Service wrote about. And we just left Lake LaBarge, and we were coming around a corner, and we were like playing some music on a Bluetooth speaker, just kind of burning the day, paddling. And as we rounded a corner, I like saw some movement on the right shore, and like turned off the speaker, and this massive like blonde grizzly bear was like just kind of slowly sauntering along the bank. And we just kind of floated and watched it for a little bit. And he kind of took notice of us and then just slowly like went into the shrubs and like the willows on the bank and just kind of disappeared. And we're like, oh, that was awesome. And then around, still kind of high on that, like around the next corner we go, the very next corner we round the bend, and there's like a little meadow with some woods behind it right on the river. And there's three massive wolves, like all white gray wolves with like some red tint down their back. And they're like just hanging out, messing around in the meadow. And we're like silently floating around the corner in our canoe, and they see us or hear us. And two of them like skirt back into the woods, kind of like the grizzly, like retreating. And then one of them just like slowly like puts his chest up and slowly walks down paw by paw to the river's edge. And we're probably like, I don't know, 25 feet from him in the middle of the channel of the river. And he's on the shore, and we're just like eyeing each other up. And as we go around this bend, he watches us and his like head turns as we float away. And we're watching him just silently like, holy cow, like that, this is, we are definitely in it, man. Like we are in it. I think after that, we actually took a pull of some whiskey that we had left over from Whitehorse as like a celebration. We're like, all right, cheers. We're in it now, man. We're in it.
That's freaking awesome, man. That's so cool. Gosh, the Mississippi you did solo, 100 days, over 100 days. And this one, not a short adventure by any means, 70 days or 103 days, 70 days. Two people. So you had Jackson with you. What was it like getting used to a partner in the same vessel as you?
It was definitely different. It was definitely different. That was one of the challenges I was like, not challenges, but aspects that I was curious about going into it as well. Yeah, because that's a totally different ballgame, having two people or a group of people rather than just yourself. But it worked out amazingly. Jackson and I were like best friends in high school, or real good friends. So we kind of grew up together, and we'd done a bunch of trips together, all kinds of trips together. So we knew, and we were comfortable with each other and knew each other well, and knew how we both camped. So we knew we had like similar styles, and it worked out great. There was a few times, a few instances where we were not necessarily at each other, but I think I probably pissed him off more than he bothered me. But I was like sleeping in for a while. You know, our communication wasn't clear on when we were starting the days for a stretch. And so I was probably sleeping in longer than he liked. And so that was a little you know, a little stress. And then I was just talking with him the other day about the trip, and he mentioned that he had a watch, and I didn't even think about it, since the trip until he brought it up, and he was saying like, you know, you were pissed off at me about this. And I was like, oh, I didn't even think about it. But he had a watch and it would beep every hour. And I was, you know, kind of in the Zen mode of the wilderness, like no time. It's 24 hours sunlight up there. There's no reason, you know, you could paddle at 3 a.m., which we often did because it was less windy. So he had a watch. It would beep every hour. And eventually the watch broke. Ironically, as he was trying to turn the beep off, because I was complaining to him about the beep, the watch broke. And, it was funny because he said that was like a pivotal moment for him. It was like, oh crap. Like everything that I have to hold on to as far as time and like holding on to a normal structure is now gone. And he said after that, it was like great, cause he fully got engulfed into the woods. But, that was another little tension thing. But other than that, no, man, it was great. We were all on the same page and we still are best friends, really good buddies. And, yeah, hope there's more to come.
Sounds like you were right about the watch too. He was able to enjoy it a little more, really immerse himself. That is probably one of the coolest aspects about this trip, is the ability to immerse yourself completely for 70 days. Like with the Mississippi, I'm sure you had service a lot of the time, or at least the ability to stop at a lot of towns. There was a lot more boat traffic. This feels like you have no other choice but to disconnect for a large majority of this adventure. Was that true?
Yes, absolutely, man. Yeah. And it was awesome in that aspect. Totally. You know, there's something to be said for, like the short trips are amazing, you know, weekend trips, week trips, whenever I can do them, I do. But there's something to be said for those longer trips where, you know, it takes maybe 4 or 5 days to get into the zone. And then you're finally engulfed on some of the shorter trips, then, you know, you're right back to it. And you're already looking, you're like, oh, okay. In a couple of days we have to hike out of here or whatever it may be. But yeah, man, on a 70-day trip, you were living every day, just, you know, making it to the next camp spot, trying to find water, thinking about the food you're going to make and eat, just living with the river really. And living in the bush, man, it was great. And yeah, we had one Garmin inReach with us. So, if we had like clear skies, we could send out, occasional text messages, no voice calls, but we did have that communication line. So we sent out text messages occasionally, but, other than that, yeah, it was just the two of us and, in the interior of Alaska and whoever we, happened to run into.
Speaking of which, any strange encounters or things still unexplained, or just something that you find really interesting, a story about an encounter?
You know, not strange wise, I don't think. Lots of amazing, really good encounters. Two of them I guess one's strange one. I guess I count this one as strange. We were paddling one day, and as we've mentioned, in the middle of nowhere, so you don't hear boats that often. And we heard a boat off in the distance, kind of like beelining it right towards us. And as it got closer, sure enough, yeah, it was coming right towards us. And we're like, what the hell is going on, you know? And it pulls up next to us, and it's this guy his name's Steven, and his wife and their, like, his wife's friend. And they were just out for a cruise. They're from the village, the next village that we were going to. And, you know, they stopped up, pulled up, and were like, hey, you guys look like you need a beer. And, of course, we weren't going to turn that down. So we linked up with them and hung out for, you know, a few hours, just talking on their boat and having a couple beers. And so after we were hanging out with them for a while, they're like, all right, well, it's only like 5 or 6 miles down to town. So why don't you just bring your stuff in our boat, and we're going there anyway, so we'll just take you down to town. And that was the only time that we had like thought about, you know, hitching a ride, or really the only availability we had too, as far as versus paddling every single mile. But we're like, yeah, let's do it. So we load our stuff in the boat and he starts bombing it. And it's a big river, lots of sandbars, and the sandbars are always moving in location with the currents and the flows. And sure enough, he's bombing it. It's kind of like dusky out. It's 24 hours sunlight, but there's like a few hours where it's kind of just like a setting sun. And sure enough, there's like a sandbar pops up in the middle of the river right in front of us. And me and Jackson are both like, sandbar! And we slam into it, going really fast. He basically beaches the whole boat. The canoe flies out of the bow of the boat. Everyone was fine. Like, our gear was slammed, but everybody was fine. And we spent the next 2 hours like hopped out of the boat, trying to, you know, like shimmy and shake the boat off of the sandbar, like digging underneath it to get air and water underneath it. I think eventually what we did was we had a few logs that we like put underneath it and got it rolling a little bit. But it was bad. And, then as we were like leaving, Stephen was like, all right, we got the boat back in, you know, hop back in and let's go. And he looked over at his wife, and his wife just gave him like, you know, the look if you have a significant other where it's like, no, like we're not taking these two boys any farther. So we ended up just like realizing it, and we're like, ah, we'll just stay here. So we ended up sleeping on this like sand mud bar, as they went back and went to town. But, it was a funny story. And, they ended up helping us out when we went into town the next day, getting some resupplies and stuff anyway. So it all worked out, but that was pretty funny.
Golly. The things you can't plan for, you know?
Yeah,
moving
exactly.
Sandbars. Holy cow. That is, that is interesting. That's one of my favorite things about these big adventures is just the unexpected encounters like that and the unexpected problems, really. Speaking of that, what was maybe something that became really important with this adventure, or something that you kind of maybe under-planned for?
I think a couple things, but water was, it seems weird, and in retrospect, I've learned more and would do things differently, but it seems weird being in a river and being worried about water, but it's like a really big, muddy, silty river. So whenever we could, we were looking for fresh water, which was basically like creeks and little tributaries or different rivers that would pour into the Yukon, and that's where we would refill our water. And it was always, not always, but there were stretches where it was tough to find good water sources, and there was times where we were like drinking out of pretty gnarly like filtering out of pretty gnarly puddles on sandbars that were basically like rain puddles and like you know, birds had been hanging out in and stuff. It was not great. So that was a challenge. In retrospect, I would have figured out how to settle water a lot better. We did a little bit of that, but not as much as we should have. So the water got to be a struggle sometimes, and we were like fighting. There was times where we were fighting, you know, not quite having adequate water supplies, which, yeah, again, is kind of stupid, but that's the truth. And what else? I think that's the big one as far as that, yeah.
Wow, that is awesome. But that also kind of scary, you know, like, oh gosh, water.
Yeah.
Having to worry about it. It's like being at the ocean, you know, it's torture. All this
exactly.
Water, nothing to drink.
Same thing, exactly.
Wow. So how did you guys, with planning and with, you know, I saw you the buckets of food and buckets of supplies, do you feel like you had what you need, or was there something else you wish you would have brought?
You know, I think we were pretty set, to be honest. We had more food than we needed. Part of that was probably because we were supplemented all the time by fresh salmon that people would give us. Anytime we'd run into somebody, basically, they'd hook us up give us a jar of salmon, or oftentimes like we'd run into a fisherman and they'd just give us like a whole fish, just throw us a fish in the canoe. And then we'd, fillet it up and throw it on the fire on the grill that night. But yeah, we had plenty of food. There was stuff that we had from the start, I think, that we still had 70 days later, which is probably bad packing because that means we never wanted to eat it. It just sat at the bottom of the barrel the whole time. So we had plenty of food. One thing that came really in handy, which we weren't sure was going to at the beginning, was bug tarp. I have like a sort of Eureka, just some people call it like a tundra tarp or a bug shelter, basically. It's just a tarp that has nets that hangs off of the side that go to the ground. And there was times in the beginning of the trip, we thought we weren't even going to be using it. Like the first 15, 20 days, there was no bugs. And then later on in the trip, there was times where the mosquitoes were just like terrible, the worst mosquitoes I've experienced. And so that bug tarp was massive because we'd set it up and we'd hang out under there in the evenings and, you know, make dinner and be able to hang out and chill without just being absolutely crushed by mosquitoes on every inch of your body.
You know, the joke is Alaska's state bird is the mosquito. I'm sure 1,000 people told you that.
Oh, yeah, it's true.
It's true. The things are enormous. Holy cow. Well, let me ask this. What would you say, thinking back on the adventure, what is there a memory that brings, you know, maybe a pretty big smile to your face or something that happened, a story or a day or a sunset, anything that can kind of make us all a little jealous?
Great questions, man. There's a bunch of them, man, a bunch. But I think the ones that really come to mind are there's one day in the Yukon Flats. It just kind of like encompassed the whole experience, particularly of the Yukon. We're in the Yukon Flats, and there's these massive things called fish wheels that a lot of the natives use to catch their allotment of salmon to provide for their family and village for the season. And it's like this massive, amazing structure. It's just a big wheel. It's like a miniature Ferris wheel, kind of, that sits in the water, and it rotates with the current. The current pushes it, and it's all handmade with like saplings that they bend into place and then put netting on, and the salmon swimming upstream gets scooped up by this fish wheel and then funneled into like a holding box. And these things are all over the Yukon, all over. And so we were paddling kind of close to one time, and people are like territorial of them because that's how they provide for their family. You know, that's like their hunting and fishing ground. So, you know, you don't like people snooping around your fish wheel. And we were like paddling next to one, just like awe inspired by it kind of. And some dude walks out on the peninsula and he's like, "Hey, you guys, like, come over here." So we paddle over and talk to him. His name's Bruce. And he's got like, he's wearing socks. Keep in mind, it's like all, he's got like a base camp set up, but all built with logs and tarps. And he's in socks that are just like all dirty, like a button down shirt and jeans. And he's got like a massive rifle on one side and a shotgun on the other side. And he's like, "Hey, come on up here." And we walk up, and basically it was Bruce and his nephew Gino. Gino was the guy running the fish camp, and it was their fish camp for the season where they would harvest all their fish. And it's basically just like an outpost. Any hunters or something might know, like, they, people still say deer camp is just like where you go to hunt deer. So this is their fish camp, and they took us in, and we hung out with them, I think, for 2 days at fish camp and watched them, you know, catch all the salmon. There was like a smoking shelter going on where there was probably like, I don't even know, 60 or 70, maybe 100 salmon hanging from logs being slow smoked, you know, all the different cuts and the eggs laid out over the coals, like the carcasses hanging and drying to be fed to the dog teams. And just like doing that whole process with them, and like the fish wheel was like probably, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 yards out into the current from the bank. And they had these two logs that you had to walk on, real crickety, going in the fast current out to the fish wheel. And like, we were running back and forth with the kids that were running around camp, throwing them off and like, as they would like swim in the river and running back to the fish wheel and catching fish. And yeah, that whole experience was really just awesome, to see that life. And, they gave us a bunch of moose ribs that we had for like the next 3 nights. And, yeah, it was just a really awesome experience to be welcomed into fish camp like that. And kind of see how things went down in their way of life.
Wow. Another experience you can't plan for, you know, you got to let the framework of the adventure bring these things about. Your favorite, totally. I tell people all the time, your favorite memories from the trip you're about to go on, you have no idea what they are yet. It's not going to be what you think it is. It's going to be stuff like fish camp with a fish wheel that you didn't even know existed before this. So.
Exactly, 100%.
That is awesome. So as you got closer, you talked about the three different styles of the river, and I know we're almost out of time, but if you've got a little time, I'd love to ask a few more
questions.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Cool. What was going through your mind, or what was the river like as you started getting closer to the Bering Sea? And then where was your finish line, technically?
Yeah, so the finish line is a little village of Emonic, which sits right at the mouth of the Yukon where it meets the Bering Sea. It's a little fishing village. They have like one of the only like processing plants in the area where they process local fishermen's salmon and ship it off for fresh Alaskan salmon. So they have like a little industry there. Small village though, maybe, I don't know, a few thousand people probably. And so that's the ending point. That's where we had a little bush plane out of to fly back towards, there was a few stops along the way, but to fly back towards Whitehorse. Or actually towards Anchorage is where we went. So that was the ending point, but the actual ending point was about 20 miles past Emonic, where the Yukon actually like dumps out into the Bering Sea. It's a little bit past the village. So we ended there, and we arranged with actually the mayor of Emonic to meet us and pick us up in his motorboat the next day once we reached the Bering Sea, and he drove us back upstream 20 miles to Emonic, or however far it was, I forget. I think it's 20 miles back to Emonic. That's where we flew out of. So that's kind of how it ended. But as we were winding down, it was getting towards August, and fall was kind of setting in up north there, which is wild. But we're ways up there. And so it was cold, and there had been like 2 weeks or more of just straight wind and rain towards the end of the trip, where we never saw the sun. And that was tough. So like we were never, you know, there was days or, you know, week stretches where we were never really dry. Like you put your rain gear on and it was already soaked through from the day before, and it was just kind of wet and soppy, and it just kind of was what it was. And it was cold, and the river was really big at that point and wide. And when it was windy and cold and rainy, those waves on the river would pick up. And so those last couple weeks were tough, man. We fought through it. We had a great time still, but they were tough. And the finish line was definitely on our minds. I don't think we would lie about that.
that sounds pretty rough, especially if I'm not mistaken. You're kind of out of probably the real mountainous pretty areas, maybe not, but the river's so big, so wide,
yeah,
it probably was difficult to be like, in raining, you couldn't see anything anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Not really anywhere to like, not many good places to take shelter and get out of the rain. So yeah, it wasn't ideal, but eventually, the last 2 days, the sun came out, and it was like a perfect ending to the trip with like some warmer weather, and we were able to dry stuff out. And it was a great way to end it.
Wow. So looking back, you know, nearly 4 years now, it will be, what would you say has been just one of the major lessons you've learned from this experience that you didn't know after the Mississippi trip?
That I didn't know after the Mississippi. A lot of the Mississippi things I learned were reinforced, I would say.
Okay.
Like just being open to new people and, you know, like everybody has a story. If you just like meet a random person and talk with them, they're probably interesting. They probably have a story, no matter who they are, even if they don't think it's a good story, it probably is. And so that was reinforced, but that was different than the Mississippi. My general takeaway, a lot of it has to do with what we've talked about, which is like the native culture out there. I had no idea, you know, the like depth of it and how it all worked and, how big of a population, the native culture is up in Alaska, especially in the interior, but all over. And like how close they still live to the land and just their relationship with the state, with the country, with like their land, with the idea of wilderness. All that's amazing, man. It was really cool and also interesting. Just like you would not think, you know, talking to you from outside of Chicago here today, that there's Americans that, you know, vote for the president just like you and I who live the way they do without, you know, a lot of them without plumbing and, oftentimes not proper heat and like, some pretty beat down environments, shacks and stuff, living off of salmon and moose, but they do. And yeah, it's really interesting.
I mean, Chicago specifically, think about some of the extreme lifestyles there in contrast to what you just described. It's pretty amazing the range of lifestyles and people in one country, you know?
It's absolutely.
It's wild.
Yeah, man.
It really is wild. Well, gosh, Will, this is awesome. Absolutely awesome. And since then, tell us about like what you've gotten into now. I know you're kind of using your radio skills again in the form of podcast. And if I'm not mistaken, you're trying to take other people on adventures now too.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So obviously all that stuff is still in my blood. I'm a big angler, so I love going fishing all the time and I love getting out. I get out into the woods and rivers weekly here. But I also host, like you said, the Buffalo Roamer podcast, which is a very similar vein to what you got going with the Adventure Sports podcast. So if people are interested in this story or like listening to your show, I'm sure you'll love the Buffalo Roamer podcast as well. You can find that anywhere. Podcasts are out, Spotify, iTunes, buffaloroamer.com. So yeah, I've really been enjoying doing that. It's been really fun talking with people. Like you said, using the radio, and I just like hearing people's stories. So that's been really cool. And I've gotten really good feedback from that. And I'm looking forward to having you on, Mason, and talking to you too. So yeah, go subscribe to the Buffalo Roamer podcast and check us out, if you can. And then buffaloroamer.com is the website. And like you said, yeah, trying to take people out, or I am taking people out into the woods. We are going up to the Yukon, this summer. Got a small group, to do an 8-day trip up in the headwaters of the Yukon, the river that we've just been talking about. So that's going to be amazing. And then, have a small group as well, that we're going to Moab in October to paddle the Green River down in Moab. So that's going to be amazing too. If any of that stuff sounds interesting to you, check it out at buffaloroamer.com.
Oh man, Will, that's awesome. I want to ask you a little bit more about that. Those two adventures, how many folks are you trying to get out?
So I'm just kind of starting it small and seeing where it goes from there. The one up to the Yukon, currently we have 4 of us going, so it's just going to be 2 boats. And yeah, it's going to be awesome. It's just a group of us going, and I've organized it, but it's going to be really cool. And I'd like to build it out as things progress. And so yeah, they're small trips. They're anywhere from 4 to 6 people. And the goal is to do trips all over the country and, to, you know, specific adventure, locations, specifically, typically canoeing, but also like to do some backpacking and different stuff as it grows. And, yeah, basically just see where it goes. It's just something that I love to do and I know how to do. And a lot of people are always asking me, you know, all my friends always ask me like, hey, you know, hit me up when you go camping, let's do a trip together. So I figured I would just kind of organize a few trips that I would really love to do and see if other people would be interested in coming along. So yeah, that's what we're doing.
That's awesome, Will. That's too cool. Yeah, that's so neat that you're using those skills to just take some people. I love those smaller trips. I've guided huge trips and small ones, and I'd have to say that size is ideal for a true intimate experience with the landscape and for yourself too, to have a better time. Cool. And I assume you just take time off with the farm. Tell the family, hey, I'm going to the Yukon again. I'll be back.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's it's lucky enough that we have a pretty pretty tight and good crew that I work with here on the farm. So we kind of cover each other if things like this pop up. So yeah, my guy Andy will be you know, taking on a little bit of my role while I'm up in the Yukon, and I do the same for him when he has things going on. So it works out pretty well.
Dude, that's awesome. Oh man, too cool. Well, folks, check out the Buffalo Roamer. Similar to this show, you talk to adventurers, from what I understand.
Yeah, absolutely. The goal of the show, or the tagline, is for those who seek adventure, and then it's the goal is to share the people, places, and moments that make a life on the loose worth living. So yeah, just talking with people and sharing their stories and moments and things they take away from doing all this stuff that we love doing, you know?
Wow. I see a lot of former guests on, some folks that I'd love to talk to as well. Holy cow. Lots of adventures. But no, man, that's awesome. Well, shoot, dude, keep me posted with your adventures and what you want to do there. I'm just definitely kindred spirits here, and always looking for just little ways to do things. I've been doing more adventures with friends lately, and that's been taken off because, like you said, people want to go, and these are weekend things, and sure. So it's becoming like a thing where we send out an invite or send out an overview of the trip, and like 20 people go, and it's been really
that's
cool.
That's awesome,
but,
dude.
It's not. We're looking to do one or probably one big trip a year where it takes travel, but the rest are Southeast based where we can get there in a few hours.
Dude, that's great.
But
especially with the fam.
That's why, you know, I'm like, I can't do one trip a year. You know, I got to do something every month or two. So just got to get scratch that itch.
That's great, man.
Perfect. Will. Well, I will talk to you soon. Thanks for making this happen. This was really cool.
Yeah, you bet, man. I enjoyed it. And we'll stay in touch. Take care, and best of luck with the show and making everything happen.
Yeah, appreciate it. All right, go have fun with the pigs and the soybeans. I'll talk to you
I
soon.
Will.
All right, man.
See you, Mason.
See ya. First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.